Does populism mean autocracy or democracy?
And one day in 1891, in May of 1891, a couple of Kansas politicians were riding on a train between Kansas City and Topeka, and they dreamed up this word, populism. So today people use the word to mean racist demagogues or would-be authoritarians, sort of proto-fascists. Here's the big shocker. That's not what they were at all. They were the opposite of that.
That's Thomas Frank. We spend the hour talking with him about his groundbreaking book about populism and anti-populism, The People Know. That's our deep dive today on Writer's Voice. As always, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres on the air since 2004. Don't forget to check out our Twitter feed at Writer's Voice and our Facebook page, Writer's Voice Radio. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. As we produce this show on October 28th, there are only 6 days left to the most consequential election in our history. Will democracy come to an end if Trump wins? Many fear so, including myself. But democracy has been under attack in the United States since long before Trump accelerated its erosion. After Trump got elected, there were many pundits who questioned the value of democracy, scorning Trump as a populist because supposedly the uneducated white working class masses got him elected. In fact, those who elected him had an average income of $70,000, which was about $20,000 over median income at the time. In a counterintuitive twist, somehow democracy, rule of, by, and for the people, was accused of populism, and populism was decried as autocratic, liberal, and, above all, stupid. But my guest, Thomas Frank, says that the pundits, academics, and democratic elite who attack populism have got the term all wrong, and they're heirs to a tradition that's been getting it wrong since the Populist Party became a force in 19th century America. In fact, the populists fought for expanding the vote to women. They rejected xenophobia against immigrants, and they built alliances between black and white workers and farmers. And far from being stupid, they pushed for policies that succeeding generations adopted as fundamental and needed reforms. In his book, The People Know, Frank takes the reader through the history of populism and its opponents from the start down to today. And the lesson he draws is that the real story of populism is a story of American democracy itself, of its ever-widening promise of a decent life for all. Thomas Frank is the author of 9 books, including Listen Liberal, which we spoke with him about in 2017. Thomas Frank, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
You got it, Francesca. It's my pleasure.
I just love this book, not only because it's a terrifically written book and very relevant to what we're going through today, but also because it's about a subject that has long interested me. I say back to the 1970s when I first learned about the original populist movement and was so surprised because I had never heard of it before.
Yep.
Most people haven't, isn't that right?
A lot of surprise and even astonishment from some people when they learn the true story of what populism actually was. Because it has nothing to do with the sort of the way the word is used today.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, before we get into the book, your title is The People Know. I'd like you to explain that. And is it also linked to Carl Sandburg's book, The People Yes?
Yeah. So Sandburg is pretty much the sort of ne plus ultra of populism in the American tradition, in the American sense of the word. Carl Sandburg, they used to call him the people's poet. He would write these wonderful poems about the lives of working people. This was once a great theme in, you know this, Francesca, in American literature, to write about the lives of ordinary people. And Carl Sandburg was one of the guys that did that, and his magnum opus came out in 1936, I believe, and it was called The People, Yes. And as you might guess from the title, it is a great affirmation of the common man, which was typical for that decade. And what I've observed here in recent decades is that Carl Sandburg's wonderful faith in ordinary Americans and in democracy itself have really been reversed in our own time among the intelligentsia. It's the sort of opposite view prevails, that the common man is a dangerous figure who, if you don't take his power away or her power away, you know, control these people, they'll go out and do awful things like vote for Donald Trump or join the Proud Boys or something like that. And so the people know is my sort of taking a swipe at that attitude, that anti-populist attitude.
Well, you know, of course, the election of Trump brought a lot of soul searching by the Democratic Party. Just kidding.
Yeah, right. No, a lot of finger pointing, but not at one another, of course, at the Russians, at Bernie Sanders, at journalists, but certainly not at themselves. There was very little introspection among these guys.
And what you've just referred to, this anti-democratic mood that swept up, you call it the democracy scare. And the idea is that these people are members of a technocratic elite. And it continues a theme that, in fact, is in several of your books, the dominance of the Democratic Party by a technocratic elite. Talk a little bit about that connection. And also, how does it relate to the other elite of the Democratic Party, in fact, of both parties, and that is the donor elite?
Okay, good question. It starts out with the people who are saying, you know, who are moaning about democracy nowadays tend to be academics, professional elites in the sort of political sphere here in Washington, D.C., think tank types, that sort of thing. There's actually several academic departments around the world, you know, that talk about populism and the threat of populism, the danger of populism. But it always tends to be the same group of people, policy elites who feel that they've been displaced by, you know, an anti-intellectual public, a public that doesn't understand the world. And so the way I look at American politics today, I think that both parties serve elite groups. They just serve different elite groups. And so basically what this partisan war that goes on in our country and that's supposed to be so momentous and so divisive is in fact really a war between two different elite groups. On the one hand, you're sort of traditional capitalists who are behind the Republican Party, you know, oil billionaires. You know, I think of the Koch brothers, stuff like that. And then a different elite, which is this rising meritocratic elite whose high status in our society is based on educational attainment. And this is everyone from Silicon Valley and Big Pharma to Wall Street. And some of these places, you've seen a remarkable shift just in the last generation. So Wall Street, when I was growing up, was profoundly Republican. This is an industry, you know, the financial industry, the banking industry. This was an industry that was very closely identified with the Republican Party. And today they aren't. We don't know the numbers yet, but when this election is over, I can almost guarantee you they will have given a lot more to Joe Biden than they did to Donald Trump, as they did last time around with Hillary Clinton, and as they did with Barack Obama in 2008. The same with Silicon Valley, which was once an industry that was, you know, libertarians would write these books about it, you know, these singing the praises of Silicon Valley. And today they identify with the Democratic Party, the party of big government, which is kind of fascinating. But it's not really the party of big government, as we all know. It's a party of an educated class that traces their status to their high, you know, their performance in school. The Democrats are, by the way, pretty open about this nowadays. This is not a secret. The Democratic Party has been talking about reaching out to what they call the wired workers or the learning class or the creative class. They've been talking about this for 30 some years. And by the way, also the need to put organizations of working people, meaning labor unions, to put those organizations behind them.
You know, it's so interesting because just recently, was it the FBI that brought the case, the antitrust case? I mean, there seems to be an antitrust move against big data. Do you think that's going to be fought back against by the Democrat Party?
I think that's what's going on is absolutely fascinating. And you see that case is being brought by a Republican administration. So when I was young, it was always Democrats that were much more zealous enforcers of antitrust laws. I'm thinking of Lyndon Johnson, Jimmy Carter. And the Republicans are the ones who basically ended enforcement of antitrust laws in the Reagan administration. And basically, antitrust enforcement disappeared in this country. And the two Democratic presidents that followed Reagan, meaning Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, never revived it. You know, antitrust had just let that die. And now you do see it being revived by Republicans in a very peculiar form. And we'll see what happens here. I'm absolutely fascinated how it's going to go forward to see a Republican Justice Department pursue a case like this. But my opinion, it's long overdue. I mean, Silicon Valley represents a monopoly threat, the likes of which we haven't seen in over 100 years. You know, populism, the original populist, this movement in the 1890s was profoundly against monopoly. And, you know, wanted the government to step in and break up monopolies or nationalize monopolies because monopolies controlled the world back then. And they do again today. I mean, Silicon Valley is, you know, their power is enormous. We see demonstrations of it all the time. It's terrifying.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Thomas Frank about his latest book, The People Know, A Brief History of Anti-Populism. So let's talk about populism and go back. We won't be able to go through the entire history of this, but the roots of the term are very important, comes from a place that is your home state, Kansas. You say that populism is not only a radical tradition, it's our radical tradition, and that it was one of the first great efforts to tame the capitalist system. So tell us, who were the populists and what was their platform?
So the populists were the last great third party movement in our political history. And when I say that, I mean, there's been lots of people have tried third party movements, you know, individuals running for president, you know, Ross Perot or something like that. But this was the last effort to start a party that would challenge the two main parties all over the country, all up and down the ballot. And they did run people for president, but that was an afterthought. Their main object was, you know, winning state legislative elections, you know, governors, members of Congress, that kind of thing. And they were fairly successful. I mean, this was the last time this was tried on such a massive scale and met with success. And they did elect governors, legislators, members of Congress, U.S. senators, et cetera. In Kansas, we had two populist governors, several populist senators, and a whole bunch of members of Congress. They were all over the West, California, Montana, the Dakotas, et cetera. They were all over the South. The only place where the populists did not have any real power at all was in the Northeast. Anyhow, movement got started in the early 1890s. It came out of a kind of farmers union that was called the Farmers Alliance, which was a huge mass movement farmers all over the country had been signing up for. The idea was that farmers were a class of people who were on their way down, who were being exploited in a kind of horrific manner. And if they all got together and joined this movement, they could figure out what had been done to them and what they could do about it. And, you know, educate themselves on things like economics and politics and figure out what to do. And what they did, I mean, they tried a bunch of different remedies. And what they eventually did was start a third party, go into politics. And Kansas was the state where they first sort of captured the attention of the nation. They came out of nowhere in November of 1890 without any warning and captured the state legislature. And their official name at the time was the People's Party. And they realized, you know, right away that that name was not going to, you know, was going to be, it was a real mouthful. And it was difficult to say, you know, to use it in a sentence and to talk about someone who supported or was a member of this party. So they had to come up with a nickname. And one day in 1891, in May of 1891, a couple of Kansas politicians were riding on a train between Kansas City and Topeka, and they dreamed up this word, populism. So today people use the word to mean racist demagogues or would-be authoritarians, sort of proto-fascists. Here's the big shocker. That's not what they were at all. They were the opposite of that. They were a movement of farmers and workers. We know a whole lot about these people because they wrote constantly. They had newspapers in every small town all over the Midwest. And they were very clear about what they wanted. They wanted America to get off the gold standard for sort of complicated reasons. But basically, long story short, the gold standard was really, really bad for people who borrowed money, which farmers did and still do. They wanted the federal government to set up a farm program. They wanted the government to nationalize the railroads, which were monopolies at the time, and which would prey upon farmers in kind of a spectacular way, and also which would control state legislatures. Those were their big political demands. They had a lot of other smaller ones, but those were the big ones. They also demanded along the way a bunch of things for organized labor, like the 8-hour day, and they wanted a lot of political reforms, all of which had to do with making voting easier and more secret and more powerful. So they wanted votes for women, they wanted the secret ballot, and they wanted the direct election of U.S. senators. At the time, senators were chosen by state legislatures. And it turns out, if you know your 19th century history, state legislatures were remarkably easy to bribe. And so there were a lot of U.S. senators that would just be placed in the Senate by powerful interests. You know, like the Vanderbilt family got their personal attorney, their, you know, made a U.S. senator from the state of New York. Anyhow, the populists wanted to reform all that. And that's who they were. That's what this movement was.
Well, it's not all that different right now, I would say.
I know, isn't it? It's amazing. When you do this research and you're reading in the populist materials, the 1890s is like, so they, one of the things they talked about all the time was the concentration of wealth. You know, they'd say this used to be a real democracy, a democracy of smallholders and farmers and whatever, and, you know, shopkeepers and things like that. And now look at what it is. It's, you know, the Vanderbilts marrying into the European royalty, or maybe that's the Astors, or maybe I've gotten them confused, or the Carnegies or whatever. But there's the incredible concentration of wealth. Monopolies are out of control. And corruption is everywhere, and it is in your face. And they talked about this. The populists love to talk about political corruption. They talked about it all the time. It's exactly the same today. It's exactly the same.
You know, another thing that they did was that they attacked racism as a divide and conquer strategy. I mean, I know they have a checkered record on that, but talk about that and how Jim Crow was a response to this coming together of black and white farmers.
Yeah. So this is in the South. So populism was, its two strong areas were on the Great Plains, Kansas, Nebraska, the Dakotas, and in the South, where obviously the South was an agricultural economy. The vast majority of people were farmers. A lot of them were sharecroppers, both black and white. And of course, the ruling elite of the South at the time, which was the Democratic Party, they were called the Bourbon Democrats, which was a term from that period that meant a conservative Democrat. But the Bourbon Democrats ruled the South. They owned the industry and the large plantations and all that sort of thing. And the Bourbon Democrats ruled the South with the doctrine of what they called white solidarity. The idea being that your interest as a white person, as a small farmer, or as, you know, whatever it was that you did, your interest as a white person was more important than any other interest that you might have, your interest as a farmer, your interest as a worker, et cetera, et cetera. And with, at the time, blacks could still vote in a lot of places in the South. They hadn't been disenfranchised yet. And so this is the idea, this is how the white elites in the South stayed in power, was by rallying these poor farmers who really had nothing in common with the white elites, by rallying them to the Democratic Party. And populism sort of exploded across the South with this idea that they proposed that was absolutely shocking. And the idea was that white farmers had more in common with black farmers than they did with the ruling white elites, meaning their economic interests were the same, or very close anyway. And they talked about this all the time. Now, they didn't really try to overcome racist sentiment in other aspects of life, but they did say, they did make a direct electoral appeal to black voters and to poor white farmers. And they said, you two groups are essentially have more in common than you do that divides you. And so you should be voting for the party of reform. And this was their appeal. It's actually very famous because it was so shocking. And you can just imagine what this led to. Elections in the South were no picnic back then. And when you throw this ingredient in and you make this class-based appeal, just all hell broke loose. And the Democrats did everything in their power to suppress populism, to cheat. And they did. They would, routinely cheat at the election time and make sure that the populace didn't win. But in one state, they did win. And that was North Carolina. And in that state, the populists sort of engineered what they call fusion with the local Republican Party, which was where most black voters at the time still were loyal to. And they did prevail, and they elected a governor, a senator, this sort of thing. And they got hold of the state legislature, and they allowed for, in areas where blacks were in the majority, for them to control the local government, that kind of, common sense sort of things. And the sort of white supremacy Democrats, well, I've got ahead of myself here, the local Democrats were obviously horrified and sat down and thought of a way to get back in power. And in 1898, they unleashed what they called the White Supremacy Campaign. And this is not like a figure of speech, as the term is used today. This is actually what they called it, the White Supremacy Campaign. It was this extraordinary onslaught of racist vilification directed at the local Republican Party and at the local Populist Party. And they prevailed, not just through this sort of incredibly racist campaign, but also with violence and intimidation. They set up gangs. They were called the Red Shirts. They would go around intimidating and even murdering people who wanted to vote. And this is how populism was suppressed, not just in North Carolina, but in a lot of places in the South. And once it was suppressed, the new Democratic legislature in North Carolina went ahead and disenfranchised black voters and a whole lot of poor white voters as well. And you see this happening, by the way. This happens all across the South, sometimes as a direct reaction to populism, sometimes as a slightly delayed reaction to populism, but always with the fear that somebody might try this again, that somebody is going to rise up and say that white farmers have the same interests as black farmers, and in this way upset the Southern system. And so that's how disenfranchisement of black voters came about in a number of Southern states, not all of them, but in many of them. And yeah, it's just a sort of shocking catastrophe. And it's part of our history, by the way, that is not well known. I mean, to this day, even though we're having this great national conversation about racism and policing and that sort of thing, this part of the story is still not widely known by Americans.
As so often happens when the story comes to blacks and whites joining together to gain economic justice. Tell us now about the Democratic Convention of 1896, where it was really the end of the Populist Party, but not of the Populist Party demands. So tell us briefly about that convention, but also what is the lesson that you take from that convention?
I guess the first thing I should point out is that the National Democrats were different than the Southern Democrats. Obviously, the Bourbon Democrats who suppressed populism in the South were part of the National Democratic Party, but they didn't necessarily control it, or they didn't control it completely. And so there were a lot of Democrats in Northern states and Northern cities who were not Bourbon Democrats. They could sometimes be quite radical, like the governor of Illinois at the time, whose name was John Peter Altgeld, was a Democrat, for example. Anyhow, just so that we have that out of the way. Anyhow, populism, the movement, the third party is growing by leaps and bounds in the 1890s. It looks like it's on its way to becoming a major player in American life. The economy goes into a terrible depression. There's huge strikes. There's a march on Washington, a march of the unemployed on Washington. There's sort of spectacular evidence that the sort of class antagonism is coming to a head. And the Democrats meet, it's 1896, a presidential election year, and the Democrats meet for their convention in Chicago. And the first thing they do is they turn their backs on the sitting president of the United States, who's a Democrat, Grover Cleveland, a very conservative Democrat. Then they announce that they are turning against the gold standard. Remember, this is one of populism's big issues, the gold standard. And it has become, by 1896, it's become extremely controversial. Everybody is taking a stand on the gold standard. And then they nominate for president this guy, William Jennings Bryan, who nobody has ever heard of. He's 36 years old, a one-term congressman from Nebraska. And, you know, they nominate him on the strength of this extraordinary speech that he's just given about the gold standard. This is the famous cross of gold speech, the idea being, as Bryan put it, you shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold, meaning the gold standard. And the country is shocked that this has happened, that one of the two major parties now has been taken over by radicalism. And a short while later, the Populist Party meets for their convention in St. Louis. And they, a lot of them know Bryan personally because they're from, he's from Nebraska. Bryan talks like a populist. He's not with them on all of their issues. Remember, they have a whole bunch of issues. He's not there on a lot of them, but he is with them on this one big issue of the gold standard. And so they endorse him also. It's a big compromise, but they decide to do it. They decide to take this gamble and endorse Bryan. And basically, all hell breaks loose. And it becomes this one of the most savagely fought presidential elections of all time. On the Republican side, the Republicans raise an extraordinary... Well, let me talk about Bryan first. Bryan tours the country. He's this sort of boy wonder. You know, he's 30, as I said, he's very young for a president. He's the youngest presidential candidate that any party, that either party has ever nominated. You know, he's an extraordinary orator, and he's touring the country by himself, carrying his own suitcases, touring the country and speaking to interested audiences all over the place. And everybody's fascinated by him. And it seems at first like he's going to win because he's this man of the moment, man of destiny, armed with this amazing ability of public speaking, which mattered a lot at the time. The Republican candidate, by the way, William McKinley, is kind of a cipher. He doesn't do anything. He just sits on his porch. They called it the front porch campaign in his house in Ohio. He doesn't go anywhere. But the Republicans raise an extraordinary amount of money. They outspend Bryan by 20 or 30 to 1. In some ways, it's the most expensive presidential campaign of all time, if you measure it as a percentage of GNP. And you know, Bryan has nothing. Right? Because he's the party of working people. He represents working people. And the Republicans amass this enormous campaign treasury. And this is the part of the story that fascinates me. There's this coming together of the elites, the sort of gathering of the tribes of the East, as all of the you know, leading members of society, leading millionaires, railroad barons, financiers, bankers, whatever, come together with the great academics of the time, the famous university presidents and the great society preachers of the day. Preachers were still very important back then. And of course, the newspaper owners, the lords of the press. And these people hate and despise William Jennings Bryan. And so there's this extraordinary consensus among the ruling class of America. They drop whatever their former politics have been and come together to oppose William Jennings Bryan, and they perceive him as a mortal threat to American society. They see him as a kind of French revolutionary figure, as a kind of Robespierre. They think he represents class war, you know, that he is going to, I don't know, set up a guillotine in Wall Street or something like that, you know. And they attack him with this campaign of vilification that is incredible, even by the standards of the day, was just, you know, off the hook. They said Bryan was a demagogue. Well, of course, right? They say Bryan is a demagogue. They say that his followers are the lowest order of humanity. It is the worst elements of society lined up against the best, and they meant it that way. So the worst, not just the poorest, but the least worthy. That's who Brian is rallying and marshaling against, the people who understand the modern world and understand how an economy works, the responsible rulers, the natural rulers of American life. And this is thought to be just an incredibly irresponsible thing that Brian is doing. They accused him of being anti-intellectual because the economists of the day would sign these, you know, group letters because he was against the gold standard. And they're like, you can't be against the gold standard. The gold standard is the prop of the global economy. They'd say these farmers that support him don't understand modern economics. They don't understand globalization. They don't understand trade.
And what happened to the gold standard?
Oh, well, I'm sorry. And I'm glad you interrupted me, because if you don't stop me, Francesca, I will just go on and on and on. I just want to say first, they denounce Brian in these incredible terms. And there's a lot of really hilarious sort of visual memorabilia of this, which I have collected, and I've got it on my website. If you go to tcfrank.com, there's a gallery of this stuff from the 1890s, political cartoons, pamphlets, this kind of thing. And it truly will make you laugh. It's just so over the top, crazy. Anyhow, they beat Brian. Long story short, they beat Brian. It was a close election, but McKinley came out ahead in the end. Brian went on to a long career in American politics. He ran for president two more times, with never had anywhere near the success that he had in 1896. He was no longer the boy wonder. The populist movement fell apart immediately after the election was over, because they had made such a compromise to get on board with Brian, and they were immediately at one another's throats. They broke into factions, et cetera, and the party came apart. And that was basically the end of them. But here's the funny thing about all this. Populism's their platform, the things that they wanted to get done, the reforms that they proposed, they've all happened. They all came to pass. Like the gold standard, we did get off the gold standard in 1933. Franklin Roosevelt took us off the gold standard, although we didn't get the full populist solution until 1971, which is what's called fiat currency, where there's no metallic basis for the currency at all.
And let's say that it's actually critical that we did that, because you can't deficit spend unless you have a fiat currency, basically. We couldn't have the relief packages that we're trying to pass in a time of COVID if we hadn't done that.
That's right. Well, you certainly couldn't do it on the gold standard. You know, they did a lot of deficit spending in the past, but you couldn't do it on the gold standard. It would have been impossible. There are all sorts of things that the gold standard forced you to adopt. And one of them was that the government couldn't do any kind of, or very much, deficit spending. They could borrow a little, but not very much, because it's all about the confidence of the bankers, you know. But, you know, all the other elements of the populist program eventually came to pass. Women got the vote. We got the secret ballot. We got the direct election of senators. We have farm programs. Again, under Roosevelt, we started adopting the kind of farm programs that the populists called for. We never did nationalize the railroads, but we regulated them. And that happened, a lot of that happened at the state level. But we did start breaking up monopolies in this country. So basically, the funny thing is, although populism, the movement, did not succeed, and there was never a populist president of the United States, the movement's legacy met with great success.
Thomas Frank talking about his book, The People Know. Stay tuned for more right after this excerpt from William Jennings Bryan's famous Cross of Gold speech.
I come to speak to you in defense of a cause as holy as the cause of liberty, the cause of humanity. Mr. Carlyle said in 1878 that this was a struggle between the idle holders of idle capital and the struggling masses who produce the wealth and pay the taxes of the country. They tell us that the great cities are in favor of the gold standard. We reply that the great cities rest upon our broad and fertile prairies. Burn down your cities and leave our farms, and your cities will spring up again as if by magic. But destroy our farms, and the grass will grow in the streets of every city of the country. We care not upon what line the battle is fought. if they say bimetallism is good, but that we cannot have it until other nations help us, we reply that instead of having a gold standard, because England has, we will restore bimetallism, and then let England have bimetallism, because the United States has. If they dare to come out in the open field and defend the gold standard as a good thing, we will fight them to the uttermost. Having behind us the producing masses of this nation and the world, supported by the commercial interests, the laboring interests, and the toilers everywhere, we will answer their demand for a gold standard by saying to them, you shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold.
William Jennings Bryan in an excerpt from his Cross of Gold speech. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. And find us on Facebook at Writer's Voice Radio or Twitter at Writer's Voice. We're talking today with Thomas Frank about his book, The People Know, A Brief History of Anti-Populism. Just before the break, we were talking about how, despite being disbanded in the last years of the 19th century, the Populist Party's program endured, and much of it was eventually adopted. Let's pick up the thread right there. Yeah, and I want to underscore this point because what, you know, one of the charges that is made by the anti-populists, the people who claim that populists are ignorant and they don't trust the elites and the experts, is that in fact the populists were right about a whole lot of things.
Yeah.
So talk about, first of all, the idea that they're anti-intellectual and they're stupid and uninformed, and put that in the context of what the expertise so often in our country, who it has actually served.
Francesca, that is such a good question. I don't even know if I'm going to be able to live up to it because you put that so well. And this is one of the fascinating aspects. Okay, so the way the word populism is used today, it's always supposed to be a kind of a battle between stupid people and experts, stupid people who don't respect the authority of rightful expertise. And we hear this again and again and again. It's, you know, populism is this anti-intellectualism. It's this way in which the uneducated reject the views of their superiors, meaning people who have advanced degrees, people who, you know, work in think tanks in DC, people who are, you know, in the administration or whatever. This was a charge that was made all the time against the original populists back in the 1890s. After all, these are farmers. By and large, it's farmers and industrial workers. That's who the Populist Party was made up of. And it is true, these are by definition people who did not have a higher education, did not go to college. A lot of them didn't go to high school. These are farmers. But that is not to say that they were illiterate or ignorant or stupid. Quite the contrary. These were people who were fascinated by ideas, who loved ideas. The populist movement would set up these lending libraries in these small towns all over the Midwest, you know, and they had, you know, their newspapers everywhere. And this, it was a sort of a movement of pamphlets. When you dig in the sort of archives in places like in Topeka, you know, in the state archives, the populist pamphlets just blow you away. There were so many of them, and they were always about economic issues. The populists were very, very concerned about economic issues, and they were not written in a foolish or misleading sort of way. Usually they would tackle the issue very directly. And the punchline of this is that even though the populists were always criticized for being anti-intellectual because they rejected the governing economic orthodoxy of the 1890s, it's the orthodoxy of the 1890s that turned out to be wrong. And it's the populists, the cranks, who turned out to be right. It's one of the sort of great ironic reversals of American history. And every time we talk about populism in this way, my mind goes back to that. And also to another populist period that I've hinted at a little bit, which is the 1930s. you know, when Carl Sandburg was writing and Franklin Roosevelt was president and the labor movement was riding high. And one of the reasons that Roosevelt was a successful president and came up, did the things that he did, was because he deliberately turned away from orthodox economic expertise in the 1930s. He had his economists that he liked and he had his intellectuals that he listened to, but none of them were from the sort of orthodox mainstream of their professions. Again, these were people who were regarded as cranks. And we have to remember that every time we hear populism used in that way, this is orthodoxy trying to slap down ideas that the orthodox regard as illegitimate. And so there's always that element of self-interest mixed in there, sort of mainstream economist or mainstream political scientist trying to convince you that you should not listen to these other voices.
Exactly. And of course, we see that echo today, and it's bipartisan. When people criticized Bernie for calling for a $15 minimum wage, I found it very interesting, actually, that Biden called for a $15 an hour minimum wage last night, as we're talking with the final debate with Trump. And as in so many things, you know, people have said this, that reality actually has a progressive bias. So that if you look behind the class interest of the experts, then yes, you're going to know what's happening.
By the way, can I just say, Francesca, the class interests of the experts, this is my sort of guiding theme in the last two books. And I think it's probably the most controversial idea that I've ever, that I've ever come up with, that I've ever sort of written about. And it is, I think it's an insight that holds true and that explains all kinds of interesting things in our own day. But it's, I just want to say here, it's something that is deeply unpopular, and that this is not a way to, you know, by proposing this idea, it's just not a good way to make friends with the folks who control American politics and culture. I just want to get that out of the way there. But it is absolutely the case. The class interests of intellectuals, or intellectuals aren't, they're not really a class, but they are part of a class called the professional managerial class. And yes, this class has interests and has spokesmen and has literature and has a way of understanding things. I mean, sociologists have studied this group for decades. But what's fascinating is to watch how this group has behaved politically, and their complete lack of self-understanding or self-criticism. You know, this whole debate about, so my new book, The People Know, it starts with a sort of fun discussion of anti-populist material. All of the different authors and thinkers and professors and whatnot denouncing populism because it's supposedly an anti-intellectual sentiment, and defending intellectuals against, and defending experts and expertise against the sort of foolish ideas of the general public. And the hilarious thing about this literature, it's a vast literature. There's even, as I mentioned earlier, there's even entire academic departments dedicated to it. Now, they never talk about they talk all about the pathologies of populism and the pathologies of ordinary people. And they can't find, you know, the Ukraine on a map, you know, et cetera, et cetera. They never talk about the pathologies of professionalism. They never talk about the ways that elites have screwed things up, about all of the elite failures in recent years. And once you throw that into the mix, that elites act in their own self-interest, they do it all the time. It's transparent even. Once you throw that into the mix, you start to understand what's going on.
And yet, I'm going to push back a little bit on that, because I actually think it, I think that elite institutions do depend on a certain kind of ruling class and have been set up in order to serve it. But universities have also been great bastions for radical, progressive thought. You've got climate scientists all around the world.
Of course, absolutely.
You have medical professionals who are saying we need to have Medicare for all. So it's not expertise per se. It's something else. It's
no, that's right. It's orthodoxy. The word is orthodoxy. And all of these professional groups, this is all in Listen Liberal, by the way, we don't really need to go into it a whole lot here, but all of these professional groups have a kind of script an orthodoxy, an ideology is the sort of the term of art that they all follow. And all professions have that. And they're often extremely hostile to outside ideas. And the classic example that your listeners will immediately know what I'm talking about is economics. The economics discipline has sort of organized itself in such a way that it defines economics in this extremely limited way. Only certain people are economists, and other people who they disagree with, they say, well, you know, you can have those views, but you're not an economist. And they develop professional languages, and, you know, even refer to it as jargon. They develop a professional jargon in order to erect barriers to entry to keep people out. Sort of professional languages, and the ultimate professional language which economics has developed is math. Before, you know, about the 1970s or the 80s, economics was conducted in plain English. And that wasn't exclusive enough. So they started using equations, and they discovered very quickly this is a great way to keep people out, to make it almost like a secret language. But that's every professional discipline does this. Some are much more serious about it than others, about the barriers to entry than others. So history, for example, has always been much more open than other disciplines.
Right. Now, I want to bring up actually a curious phenomenon that occurred to me when I was reading your book, Thomas Frank, when I was reading The People Know, which is that the idea of these anti-populist elites of the working class has in some way been like a self-fulfilling prophecy. You point out a speech, or I actually something that Bayard Rustin wrote that I thought.
Yes, he's one of the heroes of the book, by the way. I'd never read anything by him before I started writing this. And wow, what a great guy. Anyhow, keep going.
Yeah. So he talks about, you know, the potential for, you know, the public and majority was in attracting to their conservative fold, lower middle class whites. These are also Trump's base, the non-college whites, yes, mostly men. And he says, the question is not whether this group is conservative or liberal, because it's both, but how it acts will depend on the way the issues are defined.
Yes. What an insight, because that is the history of the last 40 or 50 years, you know. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it is. But
and he wrote that in, I think, 1971.
Right, in 1971. So talk about that. Apply that lesson to today.
Yeah, well, he's talking about what I have. So this is also, you know, my career, you know, what I've been writing about all these years, that the biggest group of swing voters on the scene is not the, you know, white collar professionals. I mean, that is one group of swing voters that the two parties have been fighting, squabbling over. But there's a much larger group out there, and that is the essentially the white working class, which has, just in the course of my lifetime, gone from being, profoundly democratic, you know, members of the, supporters of the Democratic Party, members of unions, et cetera, et cetera. This is also the rank and file of so many left-wing movements in our own history, has gone from that to being the supporter of Nixon and then Reagan and then Bush and that, and now Trump in this sort of spectacular way, you know, in the 2016 election. So this is a group that has both been the rank and file of radicalism and the rank and file of reaction. And it is, in my opinion, it is entirely about, like, exactly what Bayard Rustin said. It is exactly about how you frame the issues and how you approach them. And if the issues are economics, you know, workplace issues, issues of rich and poor, this group has the potential to be totally on the left, you know, and part of a left-wing movement. As I, you know, that's what populism was. That's what the labor movement, that's what the 1930s were and the 40s were all about. And Rustin himself, so in case your listeners don't know, Rustin was the kind of, was Martin Luther King's, he was his associate. They worked closely together. And Rustin was kind of this political strategist of the civil rights movement. He was the architect of the March on Washington in 1963. And after the early sort of battles of the civil rights movement had been won by the mid-1960s, both he and Martin Luther King are saying it's time to transition this movement from a movement for civil rights into a movement for economic rights. And they both said that what this means is we have to enlist enormous numbers of white working class people alongside the black working class. And that's how you build a mass movement for economic equality. And that's what King was trying to do when he was murdered. He and Rustin had both signed on to a booklet. You can find it online, by the way, called The Freedom Budget, that outlines how they were going to do this. And it's brilliant. And it's also incredibly sad when you read it, because it's exactly what we need today. It's exactly what we need today. And it feels like our hopes for that died with Martin Luther King in 1968. And ever since then, it's like everything has been backwards and upside down, and the country has moved more and more and more to the right. And, you know, we go deeper and deeper into these culture wars, and the Democratic Party, the party of Roosevelt, the party of Bryan, and all the rest of it, they have become the party of Wall Street. And instead, the guy that goes out there and talks about workers and their issues is this jerk, you know, this bigot who does nothing to help anyone except for his own friends and, you know, his immediate members of his cabinet. It's both bizarre and yet entirely predictable where we have wound up today.
Except we have seen a real resurgence of a multiracial working class movement. I think it began with Occupy Wall Street, but then Bernie Sanders and the political revolution. Now, Reverend Barber and the Democratic base, which is overwhelmingly in favor of Medicare for All, the Green New Deal.
True. No, that's true. You're right. I'm way too pessimistic. You're exactly right. Okay, so let me turn that frown upside down, Francesca. You're exactly right. And the people that you just mentioned, so Reverend Barber is one of the guys that I talked to for writing this book, because that is exactly what he has in mind. And he's one of the guys in American life who really gets it and who really understands this stuff and wants to build that kind of mass movement. Another is Bernie Sanders. Sanders is definitely somebody who understands this stuff. And there's a number of others. And you're right, when you talk about that's the base of the Democratic Party. Yeah, it is. But it's also, unfortunately, they're a base that, you know, the party doesn't really listen to them.
Well, Biden last night talked about good union jobs and
yes, he did.
raising the minimum wage. And he does actually have a pretty darn good climate plan, although I think he's completely dead wrong on not banning fracking. But the climate plan is, thanks to the Sunrise Movement and the task forces put together by his campaign and Bernie's folks, is the most progressive we've had. Now, we'll see what happens if he wins.
But I'm not holding my breath, Francesca.
Well, my attitude towards that is that that's up to us, because we wouldn't be here if we didn't have this movement that is growing. So I wanted to.
No, that is, you're totally right. We should look on the bright side of this. And here's a good way of putting it. When I met Bernie Sanders in 2014, I think, and I did an interview with him for salon.com, and we suspected at the time that he was going to run for president. He hadn't announced it yet, but that's the reason I interviewed him. And at the time, he was regarded as a crank. Mm-hmm. He was so far outside the mainstream here in Washington, D.C., and I'll be damned if he didn't. He came really close, and he really put a scare into people that needed to be scared. And, he went so much farther than I could ever have imagined that it's, you know, I can't be that negative, because the next Bernie is going to do even better. I don't know who the next Bernie is going to be, but, we're just getting started here. So
Cori Bush or AOC. No, yes, but I want to relate that.
Did you say Cori Booker? Is that what you said?
No, I said Cori Bush.
Oh, yeah. She might. Yeah, she might, actually, now that you mention it. Yeah.
Yeah, she's really.
Yeah, she's kind of awesome. Yeah.
But I want to bring this back, actually, to your book, because I think you really do end on a positive note, in the sense that you say, you know, who is the party for? Who is our government for? And these are actually the questions that I say that probably the majority of the American people are asking now. And there's been a huge increase in political involvement. So put that in the context of populism. Do you feel that we are returning to our radical roots, our populist roots, and how's the best way to do that?
So I'm really glad that you asked that too. That question, I take it from a book. So the 1930s, as I've mentioned, is kind of the high water mark of populism, the decade of the common man, and populism with a lowercase p here, the sort of cultural attitudes and the the politics of labor and working class, et cetera, et cetera. And there was this great book that came out in that decade that talked a lot about the populist party and the populist movement. And that's sort of the question that this author asked again and again and again in the book: for whom does America exist? You know, is it the government, industry, all the things that go to make up USA, do they exist for us, for we the people, or do they exist for, you know, a handful of Harvard graduates in big cities on the East Coast and in Silicon Valley who get to, you know, tell everybody else what to do? And, you know, my answer to this, of course. And I think my answer is the same as your answer, and the same that I think that 99.9% of Americans would agree with. This country was made for you and me. And I think there's a lot of things like that where you would get probably close to 90% agreement on a whole range of political issues. You know, should the economy be run so that a handful of billionaires can get even richer? I don't think very many people think that's the way it should be run. I think that the populist message is an enormously popular one, if you can get it out there, if you can get it before the public. But the genius of our political system in the last couple of decades has been in all the ways that message has been stifled or twisted or, you know, captured by people like Ronald Reagan or Pat Buchanan, you know, who've used it in this kind of dreadful way. But it's just a matter of time until we the people do it again.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you so much, Thomas Frank, for this really terrific conversation and for writing this wonderful book, The People Know.
Francesca, this is the pleasure has been all mine. This has been a wonderful conversation.
Read an excerpt from Thomas Frank's book, The People Know, at writersvoice.net. It's about how the anti-populists stopped Bernie Sanders. You can also find images from the anti-populist campaign of 1896. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.